This is a special broadcast of the meeting of the Institute for Historical Review, March 6th, 2010. Brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. This is the second speech by Tomislav Sunik.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'll try to make it brief this time, and possibly we can take a few questions then. Mark, thank you very much. You're talking about those transatlantic bridges, and I would like to make a short comparison between European nationalists and American nationalists. As you probably know, ladies and gentlemen, I think I have a pretty solid background in linguistics also, and I've spent all my life reading, and I'm proud to tell you that I'm fluent in French and German. And I always tend to, before I read an author or anybody, I always want to make sure, where is the author coming from, who is his publisher, what type of a lingo, what type of a language he uses. The reason I'm telling you this is that I'm a little bit concerned with, I often use this expression, semantic distortions. And in the United States of America, when you talk about American nationalists or American nationalism, I'm sure you have a certain concept of it. You think automatically about white nationalists, if I'm correct or if I'm not wrong. So you can always correct me on that. So we basically use this expression, American nationalism, in singular. When we talk about European nationalism, this is basically an oxymoron, and I would like to dispel some myths, if you do not mind, and I would also like to dispel some false ideas that you may have about European nationalists. As a matter of fact, we cannot talk about European nationalism. We can talk about diverse, different European nationalists, and nationalism in plural. And unfortunately, very often those European nationalists are in opposition to each other. Take, for instance, the case, the unfortunate case, the tragic case between Serbs and Croats, or for that matter, you can take the case of Irish and the English. And it seems to me, and I'm probably taking a wild guess here, but I'm trying to make some modest, I will try to make some modest proposals nonetheless. It seems to me that we are, from our perspective in the United States of America, that you are probably giving too much credit to European nationalists. It seems to me also, and I'm pretty much aware of that, that there is a certain complex of inferiority on both sides. Like American nationalists often think, well, we can all learn something from BNP, we can learn something from Lega Norda in northern Italy, we can learn something from Freedom Party in Austria, we can learn something from Flams Blok in northern Belgium, that is Flanders, and vice versa. You may have heard about this quote-unquote American anti-Americanism among diverse European nationalist parties and movements. This is almost like the part and parcel of their vocabulary and arsenal, if I can put it that way. You have to understand that even that quote-unquote anti-Americanism among diverse European parties is often mimicked. It's almost if I can put it that way, it's a coded way of saying certain things which cannot be pronounced aloud. Basically, when somebody says among European nationalists, well, what are you talking about? Those American nationalists, they're uncultured, they're uncultivated, and what have you. What basically they're referring to is Zionism, if you can read through those lines. So basically, they cannot say we don't like the Jews. They will say, well, we're anti-Americans. I'm speaking in very general terms, but certainly if you have some specific questions, I would be pleased to answer them. Again, let me just make it quite clearly. I should say, from my subjective perspective, that American nationalism is in a far better position than European nationalism. Let me tell you why. Just look empirically. This country has 200 million white Americans. On a purely logistical and a purely functional level, let's forget the culture. We can talk about this later on for hours and hours. It is far easier for American nationalists to communicate from Arkansas to Alaska than it is, for instance, for Polish nationalists with German nationalists. I'm sorry to say that some of you may be of Polish origin, some of you may be of German origin, but the fact of the matter is that, unfortunately, in Europe, those groups often found or actually based their legitimacy on excluding the other. I don't know if you can follow me on that. So unfortunately, very often when you listen to, let us say, a Flemish nationalist, of course they're just as much concerned as everybody else in Europe with this massive onslaught of illegal or legal immigrants from Northern Africa, from Africa itself. In Germany you have the same story. There's about 7 or 8 million non-Europeans as of now in Germany. Belgian prisons, I can tell you, not off the hand, but this is the right number, but 55% of the prison population in Belgium is made up, literally, of non-Europeans. But the problem with the Flemish nationalists, and I'm not criticizing them, I know them pretty well, and as you say in California, I'm in the loop because I often give speeches for them in French and German, and I was recently a guest of the NPD party in Germany. I had a very good speech on the 1st of May. There were lots of people around. What I'm basically saying, you always find this cleavage, this cliff between the German nationalists and Polish nationalists, to the extent that they would not so much be concerned with bigger issues. They would be much more concerned with those petty little tribalistic issues, which hampers our cause tremendously. Hence the reason that I think that America has much more potential, precisely for the reasons that I told you earlier. It's a huge country. It's not as claustrophobic as for instance, the UK. It's not as claustrophobic as Belgium, which is a small country, very small, like Rhode Island, even less than that, with 10 million people. And certainly America has probably a certain advantage in it seems to me, from what I've seen, from what I've studied, after all, that the racial consciousness, and this is something very important, is much more pronounced here in the United States of America than it is in Europe. Let me just give you some examples. In Vlaams Blok, for instance, has a. Let's start with the National Front, the Front National in France. It has quite a few of members, pretty high-ranking members, who are of Arab origin. Also, to some extent, we can say that this may be the case NPD is still fine, it's more or less European, but there is a tendency to open up their rank and file to naturalized foreigners, and in my view this is not the correct way to go. It is not the correct way to salvage their white European identity. So the bottom line is that if we are talking about nationalism, we have to know exactly which label we are giving to nationalism. Is it race? Is it culture? Now, these are two very important issues. In my view, it seems to me that we have to combine both issues, not just race, but also culture. But it seems to me, again, that we have to put on the first place our white European origin. And there is nothing wrong with it in the first place. And I think, again, that I'm probably, you may have noticed in my sentences, I'm using this modest approach, and I don't want to make some strong value judgments. It seems to me that despite the fact, from what we have heard from Mark, that the situation is real bad now in the United States of America, but there is a great deal of potential. An author, Professor Kevin MacDonald, uses the expression implicit whiteness and explicit whiteness. Do you know what that means? I'm pretty much aware. I have not much illusions. I don't have many illusions, for that matter, about 200 million American white Americans. I know that probably 90% of them don't give a damn what's going on. But, when push comes to shove, rest assured those people will revive their origins and their gene pool pretty fast. And I'm not talking from the top of my head. I can give you some empirical examples. I know firsthand, I'm not going to give you the names. I live with those folks. I work with those folks as a diplomat in Croatia. Literally, the very same people, Croats, who were communists, arch-communists, became overnight, literally, in 1 week, they became arch-nationalists. So I'm not ruling out the fact that really when situation gets nasty here, and which I'm not ruling out, the same very same people that you may now find distrustful or possibly without any racial consciousness whatsoever may flock to our rank and file, may become part and parcel of our movement. So I wouldn't sound as pessimistic as probably Mark did, and I think there is a great deal of potential, again, in this country, which if properly used can be channeled in the right direction. Now, I will take the liberty of making some suggestions, very brief suggestions, and then we can open up a little debate if you don't mind. One thing I certainly I would insist on, and I always do that in my speeches, and I like harping probably too much on the issue of cultural hegemony. Let me explain what that means. This is basically the quote-unquote the weapons from our enemies. This is exactly what we have to use in terms of restoring our racial and cultural consciousness of the United States of America, of course. Let me explain to you how that works. First and foremost, if we want to restore our identity, we have to retrieve our vocabulary, our discourse. You've heard the word Nazis, anti-Semites, white supremacists, and we all, so to speak, we've sort of been boxed into this anxiety, into fear almost, as if we had committed something terribly wrong. And I don't mind being calling, you know, people call me different names, whatever, my wife calls me different names sometimes, but it's not a big deal. But I guess, as Mark said a while ago, this should be a badge of honor after all, you know, because I'm aware of the fact that we're still outcasts in a sense, but first and foremost, I got to harp on this fact, and I'd like to develop that a little bit more. Cultural hegemony always must always precede the political power. And I would suggest also to my colleagues from A3P, regardless of the leaflets you hand out, regardless of the political action that you are, or endeavors that you are engaged in, which is certainly commendable, but this always comes as a second point. The first point is to create the intellectual climate, cultural climate. Let me explain that. I'm using the word culture in a broad sense. I'm not necessarily suggesting to you that you got to go to D.C. and visit Smithsonian and that you got to spend time, you know, watching the museums or Tate Gallery or what have you in England. Culture means mores. It means the way of behavior. It means lifestyles. It means body language. And this is something which needs to be done specifically with A3P prior to the, let's say, seizure of power, if you wish, or prior to expanding your rank and file to on the grassroots level. And again, how this can be done? It seems to me, again, that we can learn something from European parties, which are far better off. They have powerful, you know, people in the shadow, so to speak, like the counselors for culture and so on, and some of them you I'm sure you know. Summer camps, that's an issue for young kids. We don't necessarily have to harp on the J word. We don't necessarily have to spend time just talking about the Holocaust or the Jews. And after a while, even I get saturated and bored with that stuff. We can start with Mencken, Ezra Pound. And I'm sometimes truly surprised. I'm looking at things now from two different perspectives, both from the European perspective, West European perspective, and of course from the American perspective. I'm truly sometimes surprised that we are not talking and that we are not much more involved with the retrieval of our literary background. And take, for instance, I don't know how many of you know about Southern agrarians. I mean, this is something we could spend months talking about. Those Southern agrarians, they were our people. They were white people. They were proud of their heritage. And people often make jokes about Hicks from the South, but they have tremendous heritage. They have tremendous arsenal that could be, if validly used by intelligent, normal people, that could be used as a powerful intellectual weapon. Always learn from your enemies. That's what I learned because I grew up with communists and I grew up when I was doing my graduate work at University of California, Santa Barbara. I studied, I learned with the leftist folks and I never, never overestimate them. In fact, they're not as strong as you can possibly imagine. And do not ever assume that the system, the current system, is as strong as it pretends to be. I saw it firsthand in ex-communist Yugoslavia, how things literally crumbled apart in a couple of months. And the very same people that you now would say, these are my arch enemies, well, I guess that's human hypocrisy, they would be the first one to flock to you. The very same people, presumably from SPLC, who are now calling you anti-Semites or whatever, I don't know what that word means, they would be the first one to start persecuting the Jews. I mean, if you look at the psychology of anti-Semitism, if you read a little bit more, you can find that in my books, also some references. You will realize this fickleness in a human nature. And I still have those vivid memories from what was going on in ex-communist Yugoslavia, because I grew up there. And then I literally, my dad, he was sentenced to 4 years of prison. He was adopted by Amnesty International, some American congressman, to make the story short. The very same people who sentenced him to 4 years of jail in communist Yugoslavia, all of a sudden in 1991, just popped up as big apostles of human rights. They were preachers of tolerance, diversity, and I see them literally every day in Zagreb, in Croatia. You can imagine how I feel. So don't be surprised that the very same people now who we dislike, that's, I guess, human nature there. They would probably change gears, and they would become very vocal supporters of nationalist cause in the United States of America. Back again, a few more points about this cultural hegemony. Keep that in mind. Let me just slow up a little bit. No political party. Take, for instance, the Bolsheviks. Take, for instance, the events in Germany, or for that matter, in education, in higher education in Europe in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. All those things can be traced. I'm sure you have heard of this Frankfurt School. All those issues, not just the knowledge, not just the books per se, but the whole conceptualization, the whole epistemology, I don't want to use some big words here, actually can be traced back to those couple of individuals, most of them were Jewish, who actually created the new discourse, the new language, who assigned new values and new meanings to words like nationalism, which became a very bad and nasty word, or like Nazi. I don't know how much you know about the etymology of the word Nazi. It's a very pejorative and negative word. The National Socialists never use it. They use the word National Socialist. Keep in mind, socialist is a noun. It's not an adjective. So it was a socialist country, a National Socialist country. It was a pejorative word. But nowadays, even among, say, quote-unquote, some of my colleagues, they say Nazi. I'm proud of being Nazi. It's a very bad word. But this was the word which was shoved down our throat by the media after the Second World War. To the extent that this has become so generic, it means nothing and everything at the same time. It's a shut-up word, basically. Back to cultural hegemony. Again, I would suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, so we'll wrap up this and you can ask some questions afterwards. I would certainly be very happy to do some homeschooling, teach our kids about some classics. Ezra Pound, I love him. And Mencken is a great author, very anti-American author, you can say. And there's lots of things, Southern agrarians. We can deal with poetry here. We can deal with music. We don't necessarily have to spend time just talking and harping and regurgitating issues about the Holocaust. I mean, get tired after that for a while. And in terms of music, well, I'm not very much into music, but some of my colleagues, I know them rather well. You wouldn't believe it. I mean, regardless of what you think about this rock music, like I don't know if you're familiar with Blood and Honor, or for that matter, Lancer or Laibach. This is a Slovenian group. You know, yeah. They did much. Believe it or not, they managed to rally huge crowds of young people. This is not the type of a music I like very much, but nonetheless, you know, this is something that needs to be appreciated. And it can be. There was this big concert in Frankfurt 2 years ago by Böse Onkels. They have very dirty lyrics, by the way, so I'm not going to, in German, very dirty lyrics against Antifa, what they say about them, very dirty. But they managed, certainly, if I were to give a speech in front of 70,000 people, they would never come to my meeting, so many people. But there were guys, you know, 70,000 young Germans were just singing in choir with those Böse Onkels. It's a rock group. They play like, I don't know how to explain that music, that type of music, but the fact of the matter is that type of music managed to get to the spirit, to the heart of young people who are asking at least themselves some questions. The same thing goes for Laibach. I'm sure you're familiar Mandela with Laibach. They are from Slovenia, my first door neighbors, and they managed to make some inroads. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, prior to launching a party, prior to the organizing a political group, or a movement for that matter, you must have a solid, well-sorted out cultural manifesto, so to speak, covering issues ranging from poetry all the way to music. And I'm glad to encourage you to read the Occidental Quarterly. It's a very good journal. It doesn't just deal with one issue, it deals with many diverse issues. There's also a good online journal, Occidental Observer. I contribute with my pieces. It's a good approach, interdisciplinary approach. This is, ladies and gentlemen, the best way to start the political movement and over political party. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to answer some of your questions. Young lady, I'm sorry. Yes, ma'am.
Tom, you really inspired me even more so. I, like you, I'm really tired of the whole Holocaust and Jew issue because I know the story. But on my own personal, I've had my own personal crusade of about a year and a half helping my own country, whether it's giving them food, doing their tax returns, or doing something for them that gives them that sense of pride. Because what I see is I see a lot of broken, disenfranchised white males in Southern California. They don't have a job, and they've lost all hope. And I think through poetry, through song, through dance, and by helping them, give them that sense of pride, you lift them kind of like the phoenix out of the ashes.
Exactly.
And then once you do something for them, and I'm not doing that for a self-serving reason, they don't forget that. So then they start to understand their cultural background and become proud of that. As evidence, last year when I went to the Scottish Festival here in Orange County. They're going to have it again here in May. And it was 2 days of Scottish games, Scottish music, the Highlander games, and it was a wonderful event. You saw guys walking around with swords and outfits, and it was a great motivator for me, you know, to really get involved in a movement of helping my tribe.
Absolutely.
And so
that's the way to go.
You're absolutely right about empowering people, because once you empower people and give them some sense of pride and dignity and respect back, you've got their loyalty.
Yeah. Very good point. We just got to get rid of those guilt feelings. This is something that's not inherent. That's something imposed upon us. Sir?
I kind of wonder what the catalyst will be. It seems to me that the catalyst that nationalized the Germans in the 30s was economic collapse.
Yeah.
Now, here in California, things are going to hell in a handbasket, but everybody has three hots in a cot. Most of them got a job. Increasingly, numbers of people don't now. But still, they live. They can feed their kids, pay their rent, and so forth. So everything's fine. Bad news is something you see on TV. It isn't something that happens to you.
Yeah.
But when the economy goes to hell, and suddenly nobody has a job, everybody's on the street, they can't feed their kids, that's when I think things will become radical. And probably not until then.
Just like in one sentence, I'd like to answer what you said. Let us try to preempt bloodshed. Let us try to preempt the worst-case scenario. This is exactly what happened in ex-communist multicultural Yugoslavia. So I'm not saying that things will be good. They certainly aren't dandy and rosy. We know that firsthand. But let's try to, join A3P for that matter. Let's do something about ourselves first. Let's combine our goodwill. What I call, civic responsibility. Let's show a little bit of more of civic courage without calling people names, without yelling and cussing at the foreigners. This is not the way to go. This is a non-starter. But what we need to be, like Mark said a while ago, think about the Union soldiers, think about the Confederate soldiers. They have much more guts than we do. We just have to retrieve a little bit of that. Not much, but a little bit of that. Yes, sir.
What's your assessment of the current state of nationalism in Russia?
Okay, it seems to me again that we are just giving too much credit to the Russians. There's lots of different nationalist parties over there. This is very typical for I guess all right wingers. They're all split up in different sects and different ghettos, and I just wouldn't give them too much credit. And I would also discourage you from expecting some miracles from Russia in terms of a nationalist movement. Again, I know myself in Croatia. lots of nationalists, good people, but I just, for some reason, I'm not on the same page with them, because they live in the 19th century. They use the rhetoric, they use the, how can I say, their methods, their methodology, harkens back to the 19th century. It is not turned towards post-modernity. They have no idea. And very often, Russian nationalism is based against Polish nationalism, which is a non-starter, or against the Ukrainian nationalism. Hence the reason, again, this is just my guess, hence the reason I think that we have to work here. We should not look for some deep inspiration from Russia, or for that matter, Western Europe. I mean, all due respect to Mr. Nick Griffin, or the gentleman from Strahler from Austria, or for that matter De Winter from Flanders. But I guess there is a great potential here, and it seems to me that you just have to find right people at the right spot who know how to handle those issues. I mean, I don't have the formula for it, but I would discourage you a little bit from hoping Russia to become like a new beacon, a new light from the East that would enlighten the United States of America. Keep in mind that, again, on a sociobiological level, Eastern Europe lost its best gene pool. You know, you probably don't realize what happened during communism in 1945. I mentioned earlier ethnic Germans, but things were far, far worse. Croats lost their middle class. In 1945, we literally, our middle class was lost. What you now see, for instance, I'm giving you an idea so you can picture that. I hope you're not running out of time graphically. What you see all over Eastern Europe, the first impression that you have, how beautiful and how homogenous, how racially white this country is, this is certain. When you drink a coffee in Zagreb, in Belgrade, in Budapest, you really are in Europe, sort of a Biedermeier type of a Victorian era, late 19th century, beautiful, looks dandy, nice, fine. But you have nobody to talk to. Folks are still, they live in a very curious environment. They have those residues of communism, you know, Homo Sovieticus, and now they are mimicking passionately everything what comes in this garbage society from Hollywood. Do you see what I'm saying? This lousy combination. Many Russians that you can meet here in California, they're exactly that way. Rhetorically, they're big macho nationalists, but I, for some reasons, I just wouldn't trust them very much for some serious, organized endeavors.
Question? Any more questions?
Yes, sir.
Why would you say, in the face of this, you know, the grave threat to Europe, are they still harking back to like 19th century, you know, nationalism against other white nations? Why do they still cling to that? Is that just because it's ancient?
That's the big problem. I said, I call this negative legitimacy, or let's call it negative identity. Many Croats, I'll be very self-critical, many Croats conceive of their Croatian tomb, if I can put it that way, by resenting the Serbs. This is a non-starter. Ask yourself a question, who benefits from it? Do you see what I mean?
Exactly.
Who benefits from this internal strife between the Irish and the English? Constantly, all the time. I gave a talk just 2 weeks ago. I was in London. I gave a talk to the National Front. And I was, just as much as I like some of those people, I just resent those facts that they're excluding the Irish. Do you see what I mean? And you say, again, there are some deep-seated issues here, issues like between the Poles, the Polish nationalists, and the German nationalists. They can be 100% in agreement on the issue, let's say, of Judaism, if you wish, or the media, liberalism, anti-communism, no question about that. But when it comes to the territorial disputes, which has not been solved yet, no way, they'll fight each other. And this is something that needs to be overcome, because we have no more time. We are dealing now with different issues. I understand in the 19th century those things were fine, but now, can you imagine? And this is, Europe is the replica of California. We are getting swarms of people coming from Lampedusa, from southern Italy, on the daily basis. So I have no more time to quarrel with my Croats and call name-calling Serbs and Czechs and so on and so forth. We have far, far, far more important issues. In 100 years down the road, we'll disappear as a civilization. You see what I'm saying? I'm not asking you whether you are of Norwegian or Serbian lineage, or what is your background. I just want you to be proud of who you are and of your heritage and your cultural heritage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Visit the Institute for Historical Review at ihr.org and visit VOR at reasonradionetwork.com.